This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November the 12th, 2018. I'm Mason King. The midterm elections last Tuesday answered a lot of questions about the current political climate in Indiana and the rest of the country. Of course, the meta-narrative concerned whether opposition to President Trump would trigger a tsunami of support for Democrats, allowing the party to take back both the U.S. House and Senate. As we know now, it was more of a selective blue tide that only turned the House. And those currents really didn't reach Indiana, where Republicans reclaimed one U.S. Senate seat, held on to their seven House seats, and retained fat majorities in the State House. Hoosier Democrat Party leaders were eager to shift the focus and look ahead to the municipal elections in 2019, albeit without really openly advocating for a shift in strategy. In this era of hyper-partisanship, there really is no off-season for election campaigning, so we at the podcast decided to assume that the 2019 and 2020 races already are underway. So the question is, based on what we've learned this year, what can we expect to happen in those elections? Who will be the major players, and what will they need to do to win? IBJ's two main political reporters, Lindsay Erdody and Haley Colombo, join me in the studio with Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, who took part via Skype from Purdue University Fort Wayne. Here's our conversation. Okay, the midterm elections were Tuesday, and for the purposes of our discussion, let's think about today as being the first day of the rest of the 2019 municipal elections and the first day of the rest of the 2020 state and federal elections. So first up, we have the race for Indianapolis mayor, 2019. Let me start with that. Haley, what do we know about the Democratic incumbent Joe Hogsett? Is he running? And if he does, who's he going to run against?
So he has not officially announced that he is running, but I would be very surprised if he was not running again. His administration talks about programs as if they will be going for many more years. And so I feel like that's their casual way of letting us know. And then today at the Indiana Democratic Party press conference, Chairman John Zodi talked about supporting the mayor in his reelection campaign, if he chooses to do so. So I think it's a matter of time before he announces. I think it would be a huge shock to the system if he didn't. And in terms of running against him, I think Senator Jim Merritt could run against him. I think somebody...
Who we should mention is a Republican.
Yeah.
They're not a Democratic primary.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a neighborhood leader or two that could be critical on him from the crime standpoint that could run against him. You know, he has struggled on the, you know, to get like crime under control in Indianapolis, and I feel like Republicans will make that a big issue. And obviously the infrastructure issue with potholes and everything, I mean, there's definitely things to run against him on. So it will definitely be a very competitive race.
Would there be a Democratic primary?
There's no way. There's no way there'd be a Democratic primary. Yeah. It would be nope. Yeah.
Andy, does Hogsett show up on your radar at all?
He does, actually. And I would point out, first of all, as far as the D primary down in Indy is concerned, by not committing to run, Hogsett, in many respects, is keeping people out of the race. I know normally you say announce and then people won't get in. But by, I think there's an argument to be made for somebody saying, well, you know, I'm not sure about that yet. Nobody wants to put in the effort that it takes to win a race in Indianapolis on a maybe. Up in Fort Wayne, it's interesting that if you get into talks about what's happening in the state with students and other people, Indianapolis obviously comes up since it is the capital and it is the big city in the state. But the perceptions are interesting. I actually was discussing this with students the other day. They know about the pothole problem, the infrastructure problem in Indianapolis. One of them said something about how safe and nice Indianapolis is. And I sort of thought, well, you're only reading part of the newspaper out of Indianapolis if you're not at least acknowledging the homicide issue and the crime issue in Indianapolis. So it is something that we hear about up here in Northeast Indiana.
Potholes resonate everywhere.
That's right. Well, isn't the truism, you know, if you're mayor, you got to collect the trash on time and you got to plow the snow. Can you really be expected to bring down the murder rate, or does it matter? Do people just expect you to do that?
Well, you maybe can't be expected to do it, but he ran on it. That when you can't make progress on that issue, and they'll say there's plenty of things that they can say on crime that are, you know, true that they have done. You know, if they were here, they would say, well, yeah, the homicide thing is bad, but we've done X, Y, and Z. It's like, okay, but like, people don't see it that way. It's sort of a perception thing, and the fact that you ran on it. Like, 4 years later, what can you say that you have done on it?
Yeah, for me, it's, you're right. When you make it a central part of your campaign, you're going to be held accountable, if not by the voters, certainly by your opponents, who then will have the voters help hold you accountable. But I think people do understand that certain types of crime are outside your control. And also, if you then hear the mayor or, you know, the campaign say, and here's a list of things we've done to try and influence this thing that's really outside our control, you can rationalize in your head, okay, it was not theirs to control, and they've tried, so I'm good with that.
Let's go around the horn up north, Lindsay, real quick. You're familiar with that part of town as our former North of 96 reporter. We've got Jim Brainerd up in Carmel, Andy Cook in Westfield, Scott Fadness in Fishers, John Ditzler in Noblesville. These are all Republicans. Any legitimate challengers or upsets in the works?
Well, we know for sure that Fadness is running for re-election, Brainerd is running for re-election, and so is Cook. Ditzler is not running for re-election. There are, as of right now, three Republicans who have already announced their campaigns to run for mayor in Noblesville. So we'll see what happens in that primary. I would suspect that probably all three of the others end up with primary challengers, and that the race would mostly be the primary as it tends to be in Hamilton County, which is very Republican.
Does anybody, I mean, stand a chance against Brainerd, who has been mayor for my entire adult life?
Well, it would be his seventh term, so I think it really depends on who ends up running against him. Rick Sharp, who ran against him last time in 2015, no longer lives in Carmel, so you're not going to see Rick Sharp
in the
Jim
primary.
Brainerd run it against each other again.
But Sharp was in the primary.
Yes.
Republican. Okay. What do you think about Jim Brainerd, Andy?
Well, like you said, he's been mayor your entire adult life. I think there will be some people who will say hasn't he been mayor the entire time Carmel's been a city? I mean, that he is an institution and recognizable throughout the state. The question that I have is, when you look at the growth that's happened in a number of those cities, what's the moment where people say, okay, you're the person who helped us grow, but we are now moving into a new kind of city. In other words, we're as big as we want to be. We don't get any bigger. Or you were the change agent. Now we need to sort of exist for a while. I do kind of keep waiting for that to happen, certainly with Brainerd. But hey, you know, people keep liking what's happening. And in Indiana, we'll reward incumbency. And we don't have a problem with somebody turning elected office into a career. So as long as the voters stay reasonably happy, he should be able to hold on to that seat.
So speaking of kind of the federal level, let's move to the national election on Tuesday. What did the results tell Indiana Republicans about what to do in 2020?
Well, I think the first thing it told them was from 16 to 18, it ain't broken, so don't fix it. They had a good year in 16. They had a good year in 18. Why change what you're doing? I think what they have to watch out for, though, is Joe Donnelly, for example, did pretty darn well in Hamilton County. Does that mean that Democrats are suddenly going to have an inroad into the suburbs, which had previously been the bastion of Republican voters?
Lindsay, what did you take away from it for Republicans?
I agree with what Andy said. You know, they did have a good year in 16, and they had another good year this year. And so I think they're just going to try to build off that momentum. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see Governor Holcomb run for re-election and the Republican Party get behind him and support that. He seems to be pretty popular. The Republican Party feels pretty good about themselves right now. I mean, they're keeping the supermajority in the state Senate, and they could possibly keep it in the state House as we speak. We're still not totally sure where that stands. And they hold 7 of the 9 congressional seats, and they just took the other U.S. Senate seats. So they feel pretty good and confident heading into 2020.
I mean, there's no statewide.
Yeah, there's no statewide elected Democrat right now. This was like the last, Donnelly's U.S. Senate seat was the last one they needed to have them all.
So So what, Andy, should the Democrats take away from their poor showing this year?
Message is important, but I think part of what they have to do is accept that a tried and true profile may not be the winning profile any longer. Evan Bayh was very successful for a long time, and a lot of people ran trying to be Evan Bayh, but then Evan Bayh lost in 16. And then Joe Donnelly, who in some respects was similar in ideology and some other things to Evan Bayh, he lost this year. At what point do you say that's not the recipe for success? Keeping in mind that Joe Donnelly, as I think it was the New York Times called him, the accidental senator, wasn't supposed to win 6 years ago. So losing this year in some respects was almost like just righting the ship, or, you know, putting us back in our normal lane, so to speak. I kind of wonder, given that Donnelly had a somewhat successful showing in Hamilton County, if the Democrats don't have to find a way to embrace some of their liberal tendencies or some parts of their liberal roots and marry that with moderation on some issues. Donnelly did not do particularly well in Elkhart County, which is a Republican county, but a place where Democrats have to do well. And we had lower than what Democrats need in terms of total turnout, lower turnout in Lake Marion and Monroe County than, you know, what Democrats need. That all just sort of seems to say they've got to find a way to not offend the base by saying, you know, the left is bad, as Joe Donnelly did, and at the same time still have something that appeals to, say, suburban voters. And maybe, I know we're going to talk in a little while, I think Mayor Pete Buttigieg might come up before we're done today, but maybe having a track record of practical governmental experience, you know, running a city and embracing some liberal tendencies is a better recipe for success than I'm a moderate and I'm going to turn off a bunch of the base by saying I'm a moderate.
The other thing is, we always have to remember, too, that Bernie Sanders won the 2016 primary here. Democrats here need to have a come-to-Jesus moment about, like, who they really are and what they really believe in.
You know, I wrote about it earlier in the election cycle that Donnelly really had to walk this line of keeping the base energized but appealing to the middle-of-the-road voters. And I think we saw him go too far the way, I think, when he had the ads criticizing the radical left. I think it turned some people off, and you just didn't get that turnout.
When the first ad came out with the radical left comment in it, I mean, it was a surprising ad. And part of me thinks if that had been the only ad, it might not have been as damaging. I'm not saying that would have made the total difference, but when, what were there, eventually three ads, right, where he talked about the radical left, you know, the second one definitely started to say, wait a minute, why should a Democrat vote for you now, since you've basically painted almost all Democrats as bad? You're right, it was a fine line, it was a balancing act. He clearly crossed the line.
Build the wall is not a message that suburban women care about. Like, that's not even really trying to attract moderate voters. I mean, it seemed like Donnelly was trying to attract Trump supporters.
Let me look ahead real quick to 2020 again. It occurs to me, I can't think of who would be running against a Holcomb or who would be running for a House seat. Am I kind of correct in sensing that there really isn't much there in terms of a farm system, Andy?
The farm system has been a problem in the Democratic Party for a number of years now. And of course, one of the places they'll look is at the local level. Unlike mayors, you know, for example, Mayor Ballard, you know, if you're the mayor of Indianapolis, if you knock off a sitting Democrat in what people consider to be a Democratic city, and then you win re-election, people really should be thinking about you as a potential statewide candidate. But rarely did his name make it beyond the long list of people who, you know, make the list just because you're making a list. And that's in part because people said, well, he could never get the far right. He could never get the conservative part of the party. He had to do too many things as the mayor of the big city that Republicans won't like. That's not a criticism people are going to make about Joe Hogsett. It's, you know, they can look at Joe. They could look at Mayor Henry up this way. They could look at Mayor Buttigieg. they can look at mayors and say, okay, these are executives. Being governor is an executive. That's where they have to start looking at the farm system.
And I think that's kind of how John Zodi sees the next year going. He talked a lot about 2019 this morning in the press conference and finding people to run for mayor where they don't already have a Democratic mayor. And so I think that is, he is trying to build up this team. They've looked a lot at younger candidates. There were a lot of millennials running this year. Some of them had success, J.D. Ford beating Mike Dell for a state Senate seat.
I can't imagine it's any less than a 4 to 6 year process of really developing names that people recognize.
It's a long-term process, but you have to recognize that occasionally that star does show up, in which case you do it sooner rather than later. It's a long-term process, and the challenge is that, unfortunately, typically after elections, all the volunteers go away, the donors go away, because people view campaigns as binary. You won or you lost. They don't pay attention to beating the spread. And then the candidate who did beat the spread, or the volunteer who's now willing to step up and run for office, in some respects has to start from scratch all over again. And when you're in the minority to begin with, it's just an even more difficult task.
Let's talk about Buttigieg for a second. South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, I mean, probably the biggest Democratic star in the state.
Absolutely.
What's he doing right?
He feels like in order to convince people that they should vote for Democrats, you need to show them what Democratic leadership would be. You need to implement your values and policies in a small way and build some like concrete results for people to say like, hey, we tried X, Y, and Z in South Bend and here's what happened. Obviously he has, you know, very like gripping personality. The question though is like, where does he fit? Maybe this isn't true, but I view him as someone who would like the job of governor or president more than he would like being in the House. Like I just don't view that as something he would want to do. Because I feel like he likes to actually do things as opposed to like opine.
Right. Is he viable for governor, you think? I mean, one of the things that puts him on a little bit on the outskirts is that he's openly gay. He has a husband. This is Indiana. It's not, going to be popular with a lot of people. But does that matter?
It does. I want to go back to what we were talking about a moment ago there. I think you're right. I think he is somebody who says performance is the best indicator, and look what I've done. I think you're spot on there. He wants to be able to show people this is what it means to be a Democrat and be a mayor. Oh, and by the way, I do happen to be gay and I am married, but I served in the military, and look, my city's running pretty well. And that's why I was saying earlier, maybe that's the more attractive model for a Democratic candidate statewide. There's no doubt that there are folks throughout the state who will look at his sexual orientation and say, no, that's not right. There will be people who will say his sexual orientation isn't the issue. It's the fact that he's married and that, you know, that should have been in the Constitution as not allowable. Those things are going to happen. But in the end, it's about performance, and it's about a guy who is pretty engaging when you meet him. He could potentially win people over if he has the time to go out and talk with them and they get to know him.
I think it is worth questioning, is it smart for him to run for governor in 2020? I think it's also worth asking, is it smart for him to run for president in 2020? Because if he's not going to do that well running for governor in 2020, how well is he going to do on a national stage? I think in Indiana he is very well known at this point, but how well known is he actually on the national stage right now?
It could be one of those things where he runs nationally to like get his name out there almost, and that is like a better use of his time.
Well, since we're planning his history, his future for him, I'll throw one more alternative out there, and that is to not run for president. Not necessarily go head a large organization, although that I think is a really good idea if he's trying to raise his national presence or reputation. But instead, help the Democratic nominee in 2020 do well in the state, not as the gubernatorial candidate, but as the mayor who helps maybe a gubernatorial candidate win, presidential candidate do well here, maybe help in a couple of other states, and then get himself a position as secretary of blank and use that as the platform to move to the national level.
And then looking ahead real quick to the presidential race in 2020, let me ask real quick. This is a headline I saw. I have to admit I'm not totally up on this. President Trump asked Mike Pence if he would be his running mate in 2020. Is that right?
Yes.
What was up with that?
At a press conference. it was, I think it's fair to say, unexpected.
An ad lib, maybe?
I mean, it's not unlike Trump to do something unexpected at a press conference, but sure. He was kind of breaking down the election results to members of the media and just popped the question, and Pence said yes.
Did Mike Pence run in the room with a bouquet of roses and throw it at his feet? All right, well, as I say at NPR, we're going to have to leave it here. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this as the days come forward.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
All right, take care.
Thanks.
My thanks again to Andy, Lindsay, and Haley for their expertise this week. Before you go, I wanted to bring your attention to a couple of stories in this week's issue of IBJ. When first revealed 2 years ago, the concept for the Yard development in Fishers was pretty simple. A dining and entertainment complex with room for about a dozen restaurants and a hotel. As Sam Quinn reports this week, the project has evolved into something quite a bit bigger and more complex in its latter planning stages. Also in this week's paper, Anthony Shetley explores what the death of Mary Holman George could mean for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and other holdings of Holman & Company. Some savvy tax planning decades ago very likely has saved it from a sale or liquidation, but there are still some important questions about its direction and leadership. You can read these stories in the edition of IBJ that you have delivered to your mailbox, or you can check them out right this second at IBJ.com. Hey, as always, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. I'm Mason King. We'll be back again next week.